Today is Thursday, March 19th, and this is the World Socialist Website. Washington's assault on Cuba and Latin America, a key front in the capitalist drive to abolish the 20th century. By Andrea Lobo. Coinciding with a total island-wide blackout Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump boasted to reporters, quote, "I do believe I'll be having the honor of taking Cuba. That's a big honor. Whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it," he said, with a gangsterism that would make even Theodore Roosevelt, the architect of big stick diplomacy, blush. These arrogant pronouncements come after a series of major concessions by Havana since Trump's January 29th designation of Cuba as a national emergency and the imposition of a complete energy embargo against the island nation. In a matter of weeks, the Cuban government has announced sweeping economic reforms, expanding private business and allowing public-private partnerships, invited FBI experts to the island to help investigate an armed incursion by Cuban-American terrorists, openly courted U.S. corporations and exile gusano capitalists in Miami, and confirmed ongoing talks with the Trump administration over the fuel blockade and security cooperation. Cuba's President Miguel Díaz-Canel on Wednesday denounced the almost daily threats by Trump and vowed, quote, "unyielding resistance," unquote. But his administration's actions signal capitulation. Deputy Prime Minister Oscar Perez Oliva told NBC News that, quote, "Cuba is open to having a fluid commercial relationship with U.S. companies and also with Cubans residing in the United States and their descendants. This is a historic reversal of Fidel Castro's longstanding prohibition on exile capital, justified as a defense against precisely those layers that sought to restore the semi-colonial era through invasions, terrorist bombings, and assassination attempts. Yet, this has done nothing to placate White House demands for regime change." Secretary of State Marco Rubio, sitting beside Trump in the Oval Office Tuesday, dismissed Havana's pro-business measures as inadequate. Quote, "They can't fix it, so they have to change dramatically. What they announced yesterday is not dramatic enough. It's not going to fix it." USA Today has reported that Trump's team is discussing an off-ramp for Díaz-Canel, the Castro family's continued presence on the island, and deals on ports, energy, and tourism. In other words, a negotiated recolonization package. The U.S. siege of Cuba is a component part of a broader imperialist offensive pushed under Trump's Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which asserts the right of Washington to directly dictate the fate of every country in the hemisphere and to appropriate all of their resources. Beyond quibbles about how it's sold to the American public, the genocidal regime change operation is supported by both parties and the corporate media. Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna, considered part of the party's progressive wing, wrote approvingly on X, quote, "A deal would allow American and Cuban entrepreneurs to invest in Cuba and help Cuba recover and modernize economically." At the Shield of the Americas summit in Miami earlier this month, Trump brought together far-right regimes and allies from Argentina, Ecuador, Paraguay, Chile, and elsewhere in the hemisphere on a common program: militarization, mass repression, and a massive attack on living standards and social programs. Trump told the fascistic regional leaders as they applauded, quote, "Cuba is in the last moments of life," unquote. The United States is deploying troops and opening FBI and military offices in Ecuador under Operation Total Extermination, claiming to be fighting narco-terrorists. Not only has this joint assault seen the burning of peasant homes, the bombing of rural areas, and torturing of workers, but Colombia has denounced the killing of 27 people on its territory in an airstrike launched from Ecuador. Meanwhile, Ecuadorian courts have suspended the main bourgeois opposition party, Rafael Correa's Citizens' Revolution. The Pentagon's Southern Command is aggressively securing basing rights across the region and expanding naval operations in the Caribbean and Pacific, including an ongoing bombing campaign that has claimed the lives of at least 157 fishermen accused without evidence of drug trafficking. Trump has also repeatedly threatened the military takeover of the Panama Canal in Greenland, while frequently calling for the invasion and bombing of Mexico. Treating Venezuela as a conquered territory, Trump recently proposed on social media that Venezuela could become the U.S. 51st state, which follows similar statements about Canada. The kidnapping of President Nicolas Maduro and his wife amid a bombing campaign in Caracas has opened the country to the CIA and the corporate plunder of its oil and mineral wealth. With Trump's Treasury Secretary declaring Argentina the centerpiece of U.S. strategy in the region, Javier Milei has ceded control of the South Atlantic to the Pentagon on the pretext of countering Chinese fishing operations, rammed through a labor reform explicitly aimed at erasing more than 100 years of workers' gains, and defended the crimes of the last U.S.-backed military dictatorship. Following similar coercive endorsements of far-right candidates in Argentina, Honduras, and Costa Rica, Trump backed the election in Chile of José Antonio Kast, an open admirer of the Augusto Pinochet dictatorship, who was already launching an economic shock therapy program modeled after Milei's policies. This is not just geopolitics. It is class war. The aim is to wipe out the social and democratic gains won by workers across the Americas over the course of the 20th century, completing the social counter-revolution attempted by the military dictatorships in the last century. This is inseparable from Trump's efforts to build a fascist regime at home. Even without a missile fired at the island, the economic strangulation of Cuba is producing devastation on a scale comparable only to war. Following the removal of Maduro in early 2025, the U.S. cut off Venezuelan oil shipments and threatened Mexico and other suppliers with crippling tariffs if they exported fuel to Cuba. Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, halted oil shipments in January. Brazil and Colombia, both governed by left leaders and major oil exporters, have likewise refused to break the embargo. This is not merely capitulation, but rather complicity in defense of local capitalist interests that seek to position themselves as junior partners in Washington's neo-colonial carve-up of the hemisphere. The isolation of Cuba is stark. Ecuador expelled Cuban diplomats. Nicaragua curtailed visa-free travel for Cubans. And countries like Guatemala, Honduras, and Jamaica have moved to end medical cooperation deals that provided Havana with vital hard currency. Cuba's electric grid, dependent on aging Soviet-era thermal plants burning heavy crude in a web of diesel generators, has been pushed beyond the breaking point. On March 16th, the entire national grid collapsed, plunging the island into darkness. After 29 hours, power was only partially restored. A worker in Matanzas told WSWS that days have passed without electricity in her neighborhood. While drinking water is limited, cooking gas is simply inaccessible. She recounted that a close relative recently died as a result of the healthcare system collapse that is already costing countless lives. The medical system has a waiting list of nearly 100,000 non-urgent procedures, including over 11,000 children. In many cases, non-urgent simply means not dead yet. Energy analyst Jorge Piñon has warned, quote, "I have never seen or studied a country where 100% of the fuel disappears," unquote. Under these conditions, small but significant protests have erupted. University students staging sit-ins against collapsing education, working-class neighborhoods banging pots and pans to demand electricity and food, and riots like the recent one in Morón, where demonstrators set furniture ablaze in a Communist Party office. The imperialist onslaught against Cuba has a distinctively vindictive character. Washington is not merely pursuing corporate and financial interests. It is waging a simultaneous campaign of historical retribution against two revolutions, 1959 in Cuba and 1979 in Iran, that toppled U.S. puppet regimes. As the International Committee of the Fourth International insisted, the Cuban Revolution represented not a socialist overturn of capitalist property relations under the conscious leadership of the working class. Rather, its expropriations of U.S. corporate property, land reforms, and social measures and health and education were a radical variant of the bourgeois nationalist and anti-colonial movements that came to power across much of the world in the 20th century, ultimately inspired by the 1917 Russian Revolution. Today, under the whip of the global capitalist crisis and war drive, the ruling classes are determined to abolish the 20th century, to return humanity to the conditions of the 19th. Naked exploitation, colonial subjugation, and unchecked police-military rule. The U.S. think tank Jamestown Foundation noted in a January report, the fall of Cuba, quote, would be perceived by the global South as final proof of the inability of Russia, China, or anyone else to function as an alternative center of power. The reaction of the so-called pink-tide governments in Latin America, along with Russia and China, to Cuba's plight exposes their bankruptcy and the fraud of regional integration, or BRICS, as a counterweight to U.S. imperialism. But the vicious onslaught against Cuba, in the attempt to forge a counter-revolutionary axis of far-right regimes in Latin America, are signs not of U.S. imperialism's strength, but rather of its profound weakness. The agony of Cuba is bound up with the broader collapse of the post-1945 world order that relied on U.S. economic and military hegemony, and the impossibility of reconstructing this order on any other capitalist basis, including multipolarity. If the strangulation of Cuba cannot be stopped by appealing to complicit bourgeois nationalist governments, on what social basis can it be opposed? The answer lies in the international working class. The siege of Cuba is inseparable from the assault on workers everywhere, including in the United States itself. Rising oil prices, driven by the criminal war in Iran, are already fueling inflation and austerity that recall the 1970s, when the oil shocks detonated massive class struggles across Latin America and beyond. The class response to the torture of Cuba must be organized as part of a broader struggle against imperialist war and social counter-revolution. Workers in the U.S., Canada, Latin America, and internationally must demand an immediate and unconditional end to the embargo and all sanctions in order to end the starvation of the Cuban working class, allowing it to settle accounts with its own ruling elite. The defense of Cuba is not a national question in the sense long upheld by the Stalinist and pseudo-left organizations. As David North explained in his 1993 lecture, Permanent Revolution and the National Question Today, Trotsky demonstrated that imperialism, quote, sounded the death knell of the national state itself. Moreover, quote, the impossibility of resolving, in the epoch of imperialism, any of the basic problems of humanity on a national basis, made the perspective of national liberation under a native bourgeois leadership a reactionary utopia. The record of Castro and the myriad national liberation icons has borne this out. All rested on a nation-state framework, sought to balance between imperialism and Stalinism, and left the working class to pay the price as their ostensible gains crumbled. The current wave of capitulation by the governments in Cuba and Venezuela, along with the rest of the pink tide, confirms in the negative Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution. In the epoch of imperialism, none of the fundamental democratic and social tasks facing oppressed countries can be resolved on a national basis under bourgeois or petty bourgeois leaderships. The only viable basis for the defense of Cuba, and of all the gains won by workers in the 20th century, is the independent international mobilization of the working class for power as part of the world's socialist revolution. This means the construction of genuinely revolutionary parties in Cuba and across Latin America as sections of the International Committee of the Fourth International, to provide the coming eruption of the class struggle with a conscious socialist leadership. Trump's $200 billion Iran funding request points to massive scale of war plans. By Andre Damon. The Washington Post reported Wednesday that the Pentagon is seeking more than $200 billion from Congress to fund the U.S. war of aggression against Iran, a sum that would exceed the roughly $188 billion spent by the U.S. on arming Ukraine over 3 years. The scale of the request is a measure of the war Trump has launched. Far from being, as the president has called it, an excursion, the $200 billion the Pentagon is seeking exceeds even the peak annual cost of the Iraq War, which ran to roughly $140 billion a year at the height of the 2007 surge, when 170,000 American troops occupied the country. No ground invasion has yet taken place in Iran, and the administration is already seeking a larger appropriation than the costliest year of the 8-year Iraq occupation. The war burned through more than $11 billion in its first week alone. This supplemental comes on top of the $839 billion defense appropriations bill for fiscal year 2026, the largest military budget in American history, which Congress passed in January. When combined with spending on intelligence agencies, the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons programs, and other national security expenditures, total U.S. military spending exceeds $1 trillion a year. Every leading Democrat in Congress voted for the Defense Appropriations Bill earlier this year. In the House, it passed 341-88, with Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Minority Whip Catherine Clark, and Democratic Caucus Chair Pete Aguilar voting in favor. The Senate approved it 71-29, with Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Minority Whip Dick Durbin on the same side. The same Democrats who now posture as critics of the war voted to fund the military machine waging it. Even before the war began, President Donald Trump had called for a $1.5 trillion defense budget for the next fiscal year, a more than 50% increase, making clear that the administration views the Iran war as only one front in a broader military buildup directed against Russia and China. Calls for a ground invasion are growing louder from within the U.S. political establishment. Republican Representative Pete Sessions of Texas appeared on CNN Tuesday to advocate openly for Marines to seize Karg Island, Iran's main oil export terminal, while claiming absurdly that an island assault would not constitute boots on the ground. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham posted on X, quote, "He who controls Karg Island controls the destiny of this war, Semper Fi," unquote. The amphibious assault carrier USS Tripoli, carrying roughly 2,200 Marines of the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit, or MEU, was spotted Tuesday streaming through the Strait of Malacca toward the Persian Gulf, the first ground combat force headed to the theater. Some 50,000 U.S. service members are already in the region, backed by three carrier strike groups. On day 19 of the war, the assassinations continued. Israel murdered Iran's intelligence minister, Esmi al-Khatib, in an overnight airstrike Wednesday. This is the latest in a systematic extermination campaign that has killed the supreme leader and much of the Iranian government's senior leadership since February 28th. Israeli military spokesman Brigadier General Effie Drefrin declared, quote, "We will continue chasing all of the regime's senior officials. The series of assassinations will not stop," unquote. Wednesday also saw the most significant attack on Iranian energy infrastructure since the war began, airstrikes on the South Pars gas field, which supplies 70% of Iran's national gas. Iran responded by launching missiles at Qatar's Ras Laffan industrial city, home to the world's largest liquefied natural gas, or LNG, export facility, causing what Qatar Energy described as extensive damage. Missiles and drones also targeted Saudi Arabia, while Iraq announced that Iranian gas imports, which account for a third of its electricity supply, had been severed entirely. Working people are immediately paying the price for the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran in the form of higher gas prices. Brent crude oil topped $110 a barrel Wednesday, up more than 40% since February 28. Gasoline in the U.S. has climbed 29% to $3.84 a gallon, and diesel has broken through $5 for the first time since the 2022 inflation spike. At the Senate Intelligence Committee's annual Worldwide Threats hearing Wednesday, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe directly contradicted Trump's stated justification for the war, that Iran was on the verge of developing missiles capable of reaching the United States. Gabbard testified that Iran could, quote, begin to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile before 2035 should Tehran attempt to pursue that capability. Ratcliffe acknowledged that Iran was gaining experience in longer-range missiles, but refused to affirm any timeline from when they could threaten the U.S. homeland. Gabbard acknowledged that while the Iranian leadership had been largely degraded by U.S. and Israeli attacks, the government, quote, appears to be intact, unquote. At a separate House Armed Services Committee hearing, both capitalist parties framed the Iran war as one front of a three-theater confrontation with Russia, Iran, and China. Democrats used the hearing to press the administration on whether the U.S. remains committed to NATO, given Trump's repeated public musings about withdrawing from the alliance. The Democrats did not oppose the war in principle. Their critique amounted to an accusation that the Trump administration is insufficiently aggressive toward Russia and China, that by bungling the Iran war and threatening to abandon NATO, it is jeopardizing the broader military confrontation that both parties regard as essential. Democratic Senator Adam Schiff declared that, quote, Russia is the problem here, accusing the administration of, quote, enriching our adversary Russia at Ukraine's expense. After the White House temporarily lifted sanctions on Russian oil last week to ease soaring energy prices, Representative Ro Khanna, the ranking Democrat on the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, warned that the Iran war is, quote, stretching armed forces thin, unquote, and undermining U.S. readiness against China. In Iran, the human toll continued to mount. Iran's Red Crescent Society reported at least 47,000 residential units destroyed across the country. In Lebanon, more than 960 people have been killed and at least 2,400 wounded since Israel launched its assault on March 2nd, with at least 110 children among the dead. 13 American service members have been killed since the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran began.
This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.